Welcome to episode 5 of the 1987 WNBC radio documentary, The New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is a 9-episode series that I originally wrote and produced and created in 1987, voiced by my then WNBC radio colleague, Gary Bridges, about one of the most beloved teams in American sports history, the New York Knicks of the late 60s and early 70s. There are plenty of examples of love affairs between fans and teams that win championships after a long drought. The Boston Red Sox in 2004, the Chicago Cubs in 2016, the New York Rangers in 1994. The emotional connection between New York and the Knicks teams of the late 60s and early 70s was rooted in basketball's history in New York, where it was labeled the City Game. And so, episode 5 of the New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons, is all about the sixth man, the fans.
It's tough to imagine a story more exciting than the championship of the 1970 New York Knicks. But some of that excitement has to do with the fact that it was right here in New York. John Andres.
When you seem to play at Madison Square Garden, it always has seemed that the world is watching. You can play in many other arenas in many other cities, but you don't get the feeling that the world is watching, frankly. But when you come out on that floor at the Garden with the press lined up as they are and the intensity of viewing so great and all of the wire services and all of the major newspapers having representatives there, I really think that's what makes it, because when a game is played at the Garden, you read about it in New Mexico.
Other cities have won more NBA championships, but none have done it with greater enthusiasm. Former Post columnist Larry Merchant.
All players from outside New York as well as here acknowledge the fact that the fans here seem to appreciate the nuances of the game. That the guy who got the ball off the boards or the guy who made the right pass at the right time was as appreciated as the man who put the ball in the basket.
That championship team was known for its basketball smarts, and the players said the same of their fans. Bill Bradley.
The crowd would recognize the pass that led to the pass that led to the basket. They weren't just a crowd that looked at scores or a particular shot. They looked at the whole team effort, and many of the people who were there were knowledgeable, and I think that spurred us on to play the game the way it should be played. You go to some places in the country and somebody makes an incredible pass, or play works perfectly, or a screen is made on the weak side that frees up somebody to come across to get the pass to score the basket, and it's silence. In the Garden, these things would happen prior to the basket being scored, and you'd hear a roar because people could appreciate that.
New York fans expected a certain kind of game, and from those early 1970s teams, they got it. Mike Reardon.
We felt that we were the protectors of the traditions of basketball, and that we played the game a certain way. They hit the open man, the team style of basketball, the close check and defense, where we emphasized so much of the fundamentals and the little things of the game.
They were committed to defense. When I look sometimes at games today, and I'll see an uncontested 8-foot jump shot on a setup offense, not on a fast break, and I do a flashback, and I think 70-73, you would never see that. I mean, never see that kind of thing. It would be blasphemy to see a guy take a shot without a hand in the face.
Marv Albert.
It was certainly acoustically the loudest crowd at that time in the NBA, and opposing players would tell me they were definitely affected.
Celtics guard JoJo White.
New York was the toughest arena to play in because this crowd was behind this Knick team, and they were a great team. And they got emotional and got involved to the point where they would intimidate.
Walt Frazier learned to use the Garden crowd to his advantage.
The one year when we were blitzing the NBA, a lot of teams choked. When the fans started to yell and scream, I saw fear in a lot of players' eyes. And the Gardenitis hit them. And that's a lot of times when I would go for my steals. I could sense that guys were feeling the pressure from the crowd or whatever. And that's when I would make my move. That's also how I developed my poker face, because in other players I could see that if I'm pressuring them, that it's bothering them, you know, by their expression or whatever. So that's why I never showed expression. So a guy never knew what was going on inside of my head. I always looked the same.
Baltimore Bullets forward Jack Maron.
Other than Boston, perhaps, It was the most emotionally charging arena. I mean, it was an extra half hour of gut-wrenching before the game. As a, you know, if getting nervous started at 4:30 for me, normally it started at 4 o'clock or 3:30 when I was playing the Knicks. It just was, there was certainly a heightened feeling. There was more adrenaline flowing.
Some visiting players had their problems with the Garden crowd. Celtic star Dave Cowens.
There used to be some real wise guy, big mouth down around, hanging around the basket, you know, front runner types. And that stuff used to bother me a little bit. And that wasn't always in all the other arenas. The crowd at times would get a little bit unruly. But for the most part, the basketball itself was always fun, always exciting.
During those championship seasons, Albert King was just a youngster in New York.
I was up there in the rafters. I didn't have the great seats like I have now right down there on the baseline, but we used to always try to go to the games. We had some friends that gave us tickets all the way up top, but it was just the point of being there. But the big thing is we used to listen to more games on the radio, listen to Mar Albert with his yes and it counts.
Rory Sparrow was growing up in Paterson, New Jersey. And he said at the beginning he didn't even really like basketball.
I was the next Willie Mays, and it's hard to talk Willie Mays into playing basketball, you know, for a living anyway. So it was a little difficult to get me out on the basketball court, but you can always find me playing stickball or playing baseball in the leagues. So, you know, but I prided myself on being an athlete, so I tried basketball. And I started to like it. I tried to be as smooth and calm as Clyde, go behind my back a lot. And I liked the spin move by Earl all the time. And so, you know, I tried to put both of them into my game and be a good defensive player like Clyde and be a good passer and off the dribble like Earl.
When you're playing in high school or when you're playing in community games, as far as playing against other teams, you try to stress that teamwork. We used to New York Knicks back then in the early 70s. But on the playground, it's always going to be gun, running gun, being fancy, behind your back, spinning. And I think that makes a difference between the playground and organized ball. When you saw the Knicks being successful playing teamwork and you were in an organized situation, you try to be like them. But once you go back to the playground, you resort back to your old days and just one-on-one, run and gun.
And in those days, the Garden was littered with famous faces like Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman, and Woody Allen. Elliot Gould had grown up watching the Knicks.
The first game of the Baltimore Bullet Knickerbocker series, the first seven-game series before the first championship, was an unbelievable game. I think it was maybe two overtimes, and it was the wildest place I've ever been in Madison Square Garden. It was like an Indian teepee.
Bill Bradley.
We were carried from time to time to do things that, frankly, if you'd have said we could have done them before the game started, I would have doubted it. But we did it because I think the crowd energized us. Walt Frazier always used to talk about the crowd taking him to another level. Well, that happened to all of us, and it happened to us collectively because we had this mesh of talent and personality.
As a player, you look up and the blue seats are full, you know, every night. And you say on Saturday night against Cleveland, they're full. I mean, so the place was packed. All your friends are calling you. All of a sudden, tickets have a premium on them. But on Tuesdays and Saturdays, the whole town stopped to watch the games. You know, that was the toughest ticket in town to get.
Each player not only had his role on the court, but his role off the court. And this was not a function of a plan or somebody saying, you do this, you do that. But our individual personalities meshed so that there were really very little conflicts off the court about and on the court. And the result was we were able to maximize our group effort. And that's what people saw when they came to the Garden.
Cassie Russell.
I thought the fans were in New York were very knowledgeable. Now, of course, they don't need any accolades from me. They know the game. They knew the game. When I came off the bench, sure, that gave you a great feeling to know that the crowd began to roar when you came off the bench because they felt like, you know, you could give the team a big lift.
Willis Reed.
I don't think there's ever been a sports team in history that had as many books written about it. Not only by the players, but also by people, by fans. And I had friends of mine who wore the same clothes and they did the same ritual for every game because they felt like they were just that much a part of that team.
Dick Barnett.
We felt that given our performance, and we were very confident about that, that the Garden should be packed. The kind of basketball that we were playing, we felt that particularly in New York, people knowing the city game, they would appreciate that kind of basketball.
Mike Reardon.
If you had a seat, not only a good seat, but if you had a seat to some of the crucial games that occurred that year and in the playoffs, it was not only a status thing, but it was something to be really enjoyed. And it kept reinforcing the fact that if you weren't at a Knick game when it counted, you were nowhere.
Elliot Gould.
So it was very exciting and very stimulating and emotional and also extremely theatrical, the results, the way the team played.
Dave DeBuscher.
You couldn't park your car in a parking lot. You couldn't go to a restaurant. You couldn't go to a theater. You couldn't do anything without being almost mobbed. You were really the celebrities of the city.
Red Holtzman.
I don't think they really expected to have this good a team from the aesthetic part of it, you know, where these guys were giving them so much pleasure by what they were doing out there, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, the crowds were into the game all the time, and they helped us a great deal. But, you know, New York crowds, they kept them on their toes because if they weren't delivering, you know, they let them know that too, which was only fair, right? They were, but most of the time, they had to be on our side because we were delivering.
Rival Jack Maron of the Bullets.
It was really an emotionally charged place. John Condon's voice, I can remember vividly there. Fitz Brody. All right, Baltimore, on the floor. And things like that I never forget.
And some Knicks fans went to great lengths to keep up with their team. Steve Albert.
I was in Ohio, and it was tough picking up the games. The games, if I'm not mistaken, those years, I might get in trouble for this, but I think they were on WNBC because they had flip-flopped around the dial from year to year. And 66 on the dial was easy to get, even in the Midwest at night. So I tried to get the games, and if I had to, I'd stand on my ear to listen. At one point, I was in my dorm at Kent, and I was on my head, standing on my head, trying to, you know, it was like being a contortionist, so it would come in clear. Put it by the radio, listen to get the game, to get Marv. And I hope he appreciates all the trouble I went through just to listen to his games.
The atmosphere of constant attention could have been distressing to players. Dick Barnett thrived in it.
It didn't bother me at all. I've always been a city person. I've been always been a urbanite, so to speak. And really, you get to the point, and I think that's when you turn in a total professional. A number of people are intimidated or in awe of crowds when you walk into the arena. Madison Square Garden, 19,000 every night. We were drawing phenomenally on the road, and after a while, the arena and the crowd go with the basketball. It really didn't matter where you were performing at that time. In fact, I think I even played better when we were in a hostile situation with 16 or 20,000 people going against you. That really got your adrenaline flowing.
Bill Bradley.
I like to think that we personified the way the game should be played, that we moved the ball, we hit the open man, all those things were true. But the thing that we did in the process of doing that, or by doing those things, we really produced a collective effort.
It seems like no matter what else happened during the regular season, come playoff time, the collective efforts of the Knicks would be focused against the Baltimore Bullets. That rivalry makes a great story, and that's next.
New York Knicks fans from the 1990s remember the fierce rivalries with the Chicago Bulls, the Indiana Pacers, and the Miami Heat. But the biggest rival in the late 60s and early 70s wasn't the Boston Celtics or the LA Lakers. It was the franchise that is now called the Washington Wizards. Yes, the team once known as the Baltimore Bullets. That story next time on Episode 6 of the New York Knicks, those championship seasons. Thanks for listening. I'm Bud Mishkin.